Thank you very much. Yeah, it's really nice to be here. I did get to visit, I believe, shortly after the first neutron star merger was detected, in 2018 or so. So it's and then this is my first time back since then. Although we haven't had another multi-messenger extravaganza, we have learned some more cool stuff, which I'll hopefully talk about. And yeah, I'm going to be talking about a lot of collaborative work here. So work that's been done with all the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, with other folks in the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center at Fullerton. And at the end, about from folks that are working on a project to develop a next-generation facility after we reach kind of the facility limit of the current generation detectors. So I'll be talking about some of the nuclear astroscience questions we're learning from gravitational wave astronomy. But I'm not going to assume that folks have significant background in gravitational wave astronomy. So for this colloquium, I wanted to start out just giving a broad, fundamental, conceptual intro to how gravitational wave work. And then from what we've seen so far, I'm going to talk about some of the implications beyond just, cataloging how many neutron stars and black holes collide in our local universe. So asking questions about stellar astrophysics, about the production of heavy elements over the history of the universe, and what I'll perhaps spend the most time about, how we learn about the inside of a neutron star, the equation of state of dense neutron-rich matter, which is what we find in neutron star cores. I'm going to also talk a little bit about some of the details about how we understand our source modeling. So when we generate a predicted wave for a specific astrophysical source, where that modeling comes from, and some ways you can think about both uncertainties in your model and potentially unmodeled effects that we may be able to generically learn from observations. And then talk about where we might go from here. So I've got probably a little too much content for the time allotted. So if people look really bored, I'll probably just skip through a few slides really quickly. But you're also welcome if you want at any point to like raise a hand and ask questions. I'm totally happy to answer things midstream. Okay, so we start out, this is just sort of the very fundamental idea that if you're looking at some astrophysical source and the gravitational effect you feel would be changing, so for example, if you're looking at something orbiting something else, information about where the orbiting thing is can't come to you faster than the speed of light. So since in a relativistic theory, all the gravitational information is carried by the space-time, the change in the space-time ripples out at the speed of light from whatever your time-varying source is. So that's fundamentally why we expect gravitational waves to be produced by a lot of astronomical sources that have this kind of large-scale oscillatory motion. If you take Einstein's equations and you linearize them, really similar to the way you get a wave equation out of Maxwell's equations, you get a wave equation in the space-time perturbation that acts to map that into something that propagates. And the effect of this wave is to change the distance between freely falling objects, which sets us up to be able to observe gravitational waves through typically some kind of interferometry. So this is a ground-based gravitational wave detector. You have some variation in the length in one direction compared to the length in the other direction that sets light resonating in these two cavities to come in and out of coherence. That gives us a time signal for what we call the gravitational wave strain. And what we're picking up with this observation is a projection onto this particular detector of some arriving general space-time perturbation, which can be in this sort of two polarization description, the plus and cross polarizations. So some combination of these comes in, depending how the detector is oriented relative to the line of propagation, we pick up some combination of these polarizations. So we're measuring this gravitational wave strain as just a single quantity. If we have more than one detector, we have multiple ones and you have to project over each of them, but we'll ignore that for now. If we're considering some gravitational wave source, it turns out that the strain scales like the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment. So if you have something with an overall mass, the mass that's in motion, and a size, the scale of the motion, so like the orbital scale there, if you wanted to consider a binary orbit, then you can estimate the scale of the gravitational wave strain with something that's going to fall off like 1 over r for the amplitude. So this is an amplitude fall off for our strain, not a power fall off. It's going to increase with the mass, with the size, and the frequency. And you can also convert this into something that's the relative velocity perpendicular to your line of sight over the speed of light. So you need stuff that's moving relatively quickly to set up a significant gravitational wave. So changing relatively quickly across your line of sight. So this is something that you can set up with, for example, a binary orbit, and this general picture of strain gives us candidate sources across many different frequencies. So you can think of the frequency band for gravitational wave sources varying from cycle per year and below, so up to audio frequencies. So these are our current and future gravitational wave observatories. What we have today is, first off, our audio frequency band, which is the advanced LIGO detectors and the future detectors here. These are sensitive to kind of stellar mass scale binaries, as well as things like core collapse supernova or isolated neutron stars doing interesting things. That was first signal there announced 2015. We also have gravitational wave observatories built out of spinning neutron stars in the local universe, looking for coherent space-time variation over the scales of once per year. That's the pulsar timing arrays. They announced evidence for a background of supermassive black hole binaries in this summer. And then in the midband, this is a region of frequencies that is blocked on Earth by seismic noise, but is varying too quickly to pick it out with pulse profile or pulsar timing. There's something that you want to launch a space-based interferometer to measure, which would be the LISA project, which we hope to launch in 2037. And I'll come back a little bit to what exactly these plots are and what they mean when I talk more about signal and noise models for gravitational wave astronomy. So here's our observatories right now. We have the two LIGOs in the US, GEO in Germany, which is now small enough that it tends not to make on its own, or in comparison with the other facilities, a major contribution, but it does run with a lot of uptime, so it's sort of our local supernova catcher, maybe, in the field. And then we have Virgo, which was participating in previous observing runs, but has recently had some challenges, as well as LIGO India, which is under construction, and Kagra in Japan, which is in the same mountain as the Super Kamiokande Observatory, but tunneled out to measure gravitational waves below a lot of the surface seismic activity that can be a big background noise. So we are currently about midway through observing run 4. So this is the first observing run where we detected the first binary black hole merger, the second one where we detected the first neutron star merger, the third one, which is where most of the science results I'll talk about, also included two neutron star black hole binaries. And then this one, which started earlier this year, and we hope to continue through to roughly 2025. Yeah?
So is Kagra up megaparsecs
already? So Kagra is, yeah, so Kagra has gotten short-term observing runs on the megaparsec scale. Unfortunately, Virgo wasn't able to join the first chunk here as they hoped, but they've had some bad luck with braking suspensions and a power outage and things like that. So they're hoping to join in the new year for the second half of 04. Okay.
Does gray mean something here? Or sorry.
So gray is what's called sort of a commissioning period. So it's not necessarily designed to be actively observing. Although these days, that doesn't necessarily mean you can't detect anything. Well, actually, that's the state we were in when the first black hole arrived. But the detectors are not maintained for observing. There's a lot of activity trying to upgrade things. So you'll see that the reach currently is 150 to 160. And there's a hope that some commissioning here will give you improved sensitivity for the second half. So they'll try hunting down noise sources, putting in a lot of baffles to catch stray light, and doing other sort of detector configuration things, working on the control loops to make things more stable, instrumental stuff going on there. So that's a lot of what Kagra is doing right now. It's a relatively newer facility. They just sort of had their first light in 2020. It's not first light, first observing lock. So they're mostly just trying to improve their sensitivity at this point. Okay. Okay, so we have our compact binary source. This is the kind of order of magnitude estimate that I talked about before. Here it is with some sort of typical numbers. So the relative change in length that you're measuring across the interferometer is on the order of 10 to the minus 21 or below for a source at around 100 megaparsecs that's around the scale of a neutron star, close enough that you're comparable to the Schwarzschild radius of a neutron star. So that's it's faster the closer you get. But one of the things I want to sort of emphasize here is what you see is the dynamics of your source system here, whether you're viewing it either edge-on or head-on. So the real system wouldn't be flipping around like this, but you might happen to catch one in any orientation. What you observe at the detector kind of tracks along the frequency of the source generating that signal. So when we're measuring the strain, the frequency of the strain is connected to the frequency of whatever is generating the gravitational wave source. So that's what we're going to use to learn about sources from the gravitational waves they emit. Now, okay, so that's a very tiny fractional strain. But if you look at the energy flux carried off by the same object a typical number that you would get to close to the end of an in-spiral, you have a huge amount of energy being carried away. So that 10 to the minus 21 variation in lengths carries energies that kind of think for the outshine all the stars in the universe for a brief moment of time in just sheer energy. So this is what lets us see these things, because that energy loss turns out to drive our orbiting systems towards merger. So we have the system loses energy, it emits gravitational waves, the loss of energy causes the orbital binding energy is smaller as you have the stars closer together, so you end up driving your system towards coalescence, which is called the chirp, and you have a changing separation, which comes from the amount of energy that you're losing to gravitational waves and how the orbital energy changes with the separation. So that gives us something where here's sort of 4-2 neutron star masses orbiting each other. This is like the final stages from something like 400 hertz when they're 60 kilometers apart to roughly when they collide. This is just with like a leading order kind of approximation. So the frequency changes over time, and that's tracking the orbits getting closer and closer, and just like in a Keplerian orbit, the frequency increases as the two bodies approach each other. So when we're going to interpret observational data, what we might observe, so this is the 1708-17, which was clearest in Livingston, we observe a frequency, an excess power in the gravitational wave Fourier spectrum that increases in frequency over time, tracking that orbital dynamics as the two stars fall together and chirp up in their gravitational wave emission. Okay. So what do we learn from this? So you need some sort of model to interpret the data, and we build our source model from the sky location and the orientation. So that sets how the source is projected onto the detector. That tends to give you some overall factor on the amplitude in each detector, as well as an arrival time. Something called the chirp mass is this particular combination of masses that sets the amplitude of a gravitational wave signal, as well as the luminosity distance. Then we have an overall fall off in the frequency domain, because as you go to higher and higher frequency, it spends less time there, so it accumulates less amplitude in the frequency domain as you go. And then you have a bunch of correction terms, and then all the source dynamics happens in the phase. The changing orbital frequency gives you this phase accumulation. And that's where you're going to learn about the masses and the spins and the tidal properties that I'll talk about later about the component stars. So since we have the gravitational wave phase tracking the orbital phase, we can build a model for the phasing. And it includes something with the arrival time, an overall phase shift, and then we have the chirp mass again. And this is important because from the characteristic way that phase changes in time, we have here an independent measurement of chirp mass from within the phasing. So that lets us use our amplitude to figure out something about distance and sky location, because chirp mass is measured not from this amplitude factor, but from the other appearance of the chirp mass within the phasing. So we have our chirp mass. We also have kind of leading order combinations that depend on the mass ratio. An effective spin, which is the most easy to understand or extract combination of the two spin vectors of the component stars projected onto the angular momentum of the object. And an effective tide, which is the tidal deformability of the two components, weighted by mass in this particular way that maps to the leading order post-Newtonian contribution. So we take our signal model, compare it to the strain noise, and the strain noise here is the amplitude of fluctuations in the detector at different frequencies. So for ground-based detectors over time, you can see that generally from one epoch to the next, we are getting an increase in the sensitivity. So at 04, we're actually just at around 160, which is the top of this shaded gray region. And we find that we're most sensitive to frequencies between around 20 or so hertz and somewhere around 2,000 hertz. So that's where, beyond that region, at the low end, you have a lot of seismic noise, and at the high end, photon shot noise. Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't quite hear. So the O4 here is just a projected noise curve, so it's a simplified estimate. I'll show you the real one later. But these ones are actual measurements from an interferometer. They have a lot more couplings, suspension resonances and things. Those are what tend to make those lines. And not all of those are in the model that's used to project future sensitivity. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of what we do is measuring or identifying outliers through a template match search. So you have some model for your strain, you cross-correlate it with the data, and you find some excess in signal-to-noise ratio, which is just this noise-weighted inner product of your data stream and your signal model. So this would be the optimum statistic if you had Gaussian noise with a variance of that per frequency bin. But we don't have Gaussian noise, so the actual search pipelines are more complicated than just calculating SNR and finding outliers. They build search statistics like with some sort of chi-squared goodness of fit addition to better discriminate between the background and the noise, and sorry, and the astrophysical signals, but the kind of fundamental thing that they're built from is this sort of cross-correlation between some model for the template and the data stream. There are also unmodeled searches that look for just excess coherent power between multiple detectors. They also find loud signals, but I'm not gonna talk so much about them. And then we have from the detection pipeline some estimate of the sensitive volume. So if there was a signal with this size within this distance, we would get it with this likelihood. And we find that the number of signals that we've actually measured, which is currently around about 90 something, scales with the estimated volume time that the detectors are measuring. So we think we have a pretty good handle on the statistics of our detection and a really good model of the observational kind of mass selection effect here. Okay. So here are our family of signals so far. Each of these, they're in chronological order. The time spacing is not meaningful. So that was the first two black holes merging. A handful more binary black holes. This is the first double neutron star and the second double neutron star in 2019. Since then, we've got a lot more binary black holes. We got this one kind of mystery object, too heavy for a neutron star, probably, maybe not. Too light for a black hole, probably, maybe not. Whatever it is, it's interesting. We just have no idea what it is. A couple more sub-thresholdy things, and the two black hole neutron stars that we're confident enough to make a discovery paper with O3. And then some more black holes. So obviously, if you look at this, you know which are more common in our universe, right? The neutron stars. Because I talked about the mass-dependent selection effect, the volume that we're sensitive to scales like the SNR, which scales like the chirp mass, so you end up with a mass to the 5/2 power. So for in-spiral dominated signals, we actually get way more sensitivity to black holes at the same distance compared to neutron stars, or we have a much larger sensitive volume for the black holes than the neutron stars. So we know, based on these estimates, that we have now rates for neutron star neutron stars, black hole neutron stars, and black holes per gigaparsec per year in the local universe. And the neutron stars are probably, although not certainly, because there's still a large error bar, we've just had two, and they're obviously like not very uniform statistically yet, so we are very Poisson noise dominated, but we have more likely common neutron stars than other sources, which is what you expect because low mass things tend to be more common than high mass things in stellar astronomy. Okay, I'm gonna skip that. And I want to talk about some of the things we try and learn from this. So one thing you kind of notice as you look at this is that, so I talked about selection effects. So we do prefer we tend to detect heavy things more than light things. That'll eventually turn over as the heavy things go to lower and lower frequencies, which goes out of band for the sensitivity of our detector. So what does this set of detections mean for the masses of the astrophysical population that would produce this set of detections? So we kind of asked, does the black hole population that's merging have some preferred mass, or is it just uniform? We can ask, is there sort of a meaningful deficit in the number of objects between this neutron star range and the black hole range? Like, it looks like there might be sort of a bit of a gap there. Is that meaningful statistically? Is there an upper limit here? Do we stop seeing things because they're not there or because we can't see them anymore? For the sources that we see, for example, we've seen a lot of binary neutron stars in our galaxy. Do the ones we see in gravitational waves differ in any way from the ones we see electromagnetically? And then some of the follow-up questions we can also say is, how much do these mergers contribute to forming heavy elements, which can be made when neutron stars get torn apart or collide? And what's inside the neutron stars that we've seen? So these are sort of the science questions that I wanted to talk about a little bit while I'm here.
Are the neutron star mergers kind of ambiguous in what color they merge into, because we don't know if they're black holes or neutron stars?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, this one is actually pretty certainly a black hole. It's above 3 solar masses, but this one, it's actually right around the same mass as that one, which is cool, but both of them are right in that gap region that we don't really know how to classify them based on our understanding of neutron stars. Okay, so first off, I'm gonna say a few things that we learned from these sources as a population. So this is from a paper that's actually just been published recently in PhysRevX. So one of the things that we looked at were models of how the rate of mergers in the universe, not observed, but in the source population, varies with the mass of the component of the source. So here, this is the mass of the heavier black hole. And here, I believe this is the mass, also the mass of the heavier black or heavier component. And for example, what we see is for the low mass things, we have a higher rate estimate for between 1 and 2 solar masses, which is the neutron stars. And then we observe this drop off, which is called the lower mass gap, which is right around or right above 2 solar masses with pretty big error bars. Then we have the rate estimates rising up again. These are done with different models for what the mass distribution looks like in the local universe. If we look, focus on the black holes, we see this like bump emerging around 35 solar mass. So there's more 35 solar mass black holes than other black holes, which could be some sort of formation from supernova, some sort of preference in the merger channel, some leftover primordial scenario that favorably produces that particular mass scale. We also find that there is evidence that there is a fall off at around 80 or so solar masses, that black hole mergers reach to that high, but not higher. So we're starting to see, and we'll continue hopefully to resolve in more detail, structure in the black hole mass spectrum. If we look more at the neutron star mergers, so these are the low mass mergers. One of the things you'll notice here is we have typically kind of a substantial degeneracy between the masses of the two components. So because we measure the chirp mass really well and the mass ratio less well, those bananas are roughly on lines of constant chirp mass, going from an equal mass on this corner down to a more unequal mass. And we're not completely sure where on that line each source would be. So you have to take that kind of thing into account. We also have that mystery object I said, which is around 2.6 solar masses, which is probably a binary black hole. And one thing we can do is you can compare it to the mass where you have the fall off, which was around 2.1, or an estimate of the maximum mass of neutron stars from our understanding of neutron star equation of state, which says that the maximum mass is around 2.3. So that's what we use right now to classify these objects, is entirely based on the mass of the source. If we look at the neutron stars in gravitational waves, one of the things we see is the ones that we're observing include a bunch of high mass components. So two of the black hole neutron stars and one of the double neutron stars have components that are higher in mass than what you see in the galactic double neutron stars. So all the galactic double neutron stars lie around 1.3, 1.4 solar masses. If you look at all the galactic neutron stars, including the ones that aren't in double neutron star binaries, they have a secondary peak kind of around 1.8 or so. But there's really this preference in the ones we see in our galaxy and radio observations for around 1.4. So you'll always hear neutron stars are around 1.4 solar masses, which is fine. We say that too, except when we look at our gravitational wave population, we actually don't see much of a preference for that mass scale. We see as many at the high mass as we do at the low mass end. So it seems that we have a different source population than we would expect just from the galactic radio observations. Now, yeah.
So 1708-17 also, you know,
Yeah, so 1708-17 was right on here. So if you'd asked me, like, are the ones we see in gravitational waves the same as the ones we see in the galaxy in 2018, I would have said, of course. Then we got another neutron star merger, and it was a like 3 sigma outlier from that population. So, well, I guess not.
The other ones didn't have EM counterparts.
Right. So, yeah, all the other ones, all the heavy ones, so the heavier component of this guy, as well as this neutron star, this is our best mass estimate with a heavy neutron star component. This is a neutron star black hole. The black hole is around 10 solar masses. The neutron star is around 1.8.
But if it's the case, a new star based on the
black right.
of the masses, right?
Yeah, so it could be that these are all black holes except one of 1708-17's components, and they would look more or less the same in gravitational waves. But right now, what we do based on astrophysical formation scenarios, I think, as much as anything, is say, things that are formed at around one solar mass or to two solar masses, those are neutron stars. Things that are heavier than the neutron star maximum mass are black holes. And that's how we classify these populations. Now, this is...
But tidal effects haven't been seen for any of these things?
Not with enough confidence to rule out a black hole explanation. So there's support for non-zero tides, especially for 1708-17, but you can make the mass unequal and make them spin a lot, and then you can fit the data. So like one interesting thing is like this 2.1 gap start. So like that actually lies up right with our maximum mass of the neutron star, but it does not use any astrophysical inference to find that mass. That's just, we see this feature in the mass spectrum, which would be kind of what you'd expect from those formation scenarios. But that's so there's, you know, we'll see what we see next though. Okay. I'll just say briefly, this has kind of implications for how we understand supernova formation, but I won't talk about what those are. But this, there's information about which low mass objects are preferred. There's also information for the supernova from what's the highest mass black holes that we observe. They can be tricky to predict. The other thing that we can start to estimate based on the gravitational wave observations is their contribution to nucleosynthesis. So if we look at, this is the abundances in the solar system, we know that hydrogen and helium and lithium get produced in the Big Bang. Most of the other elements up to iron get produced in stars and supernova, but these heavy elements that exist in our universe need more exotic processes to produce them. And one of the scenarios that can produce them is neutron star mergers. So one of the things we can do is take the masses and the merger rates from gravitational wave observations, fold it through with what we know about neutron star properties, what we see from kilonova observations and simulations, and some gamma ray burst delay time estimates. And we can say, okay, all the full population of neutron star mergers in the universe merges per Milky Way galaxy about this often and throws off about this much heavy elements per merger. And we get sort of a prediction from the gravitational wave catalog about what that contribution should be. Then you can compare it with geophysical and astrophysical observations that also make estimates for those two properties. So there's a really nice paper by Kenta Hotakazaka in 2018 that goes through this particular plot, and you can see that what we're seeing in the gravitational waves is consistent with what we expect for how much our process exists mixed into the Milky Way as a whole, how much got deposited in our ocean floor, and what we see in metal poor stars. There is a little twist though. If we look at metal poor stars, gravitational waves do really well in the local universe at current metallicities, so the amount of enrichment of heavy elements of the sun. We predict that amount of enrichment from gravitational waves. If you go back to lower metallicities, less iron to hydrogen, which means earlier parts of the universe, what we see in a bunch of metal poor stars is not as much as our neutron star predictions would produce. So we kind of have two options here. You can take this difference at low metallicity, compare it to the observational data from gravitational waves, and either modify the delay time, which is difficult, or constrain some additional channel that would have to make up the remainder. So you can sort of tell astrophysicists, well, what do you need to add to the universe to match our observations, both of gravitational waves and of low metallicity stars? Okay. Then the last major thing we're learning is what's inside the neutron stars. I'm not going to spend so much time about this because, unfortunately, the gravitational wave impact hasn't changed too much since 2018. What we have for neutron stars is different predictions for the pressure as a function of density for what's matter in beta equilibrium, which is the neutron-rich matter at the core of a neutron star. And the 1708-17 posterior here is this sort of pink-red shaded region with the 90% region in darker red. And there's an array of nuclear physics models that are at least marginally compatible with the constraint inferred from gravitational waves. So I wanted to briefly talk about how we figure out what that constraint is. And we sort of start with the same chirp that I talked about earlier, this change in the orbital separation over time driven by the gravitational wave luminosity. And then you're modifying it from the gravitational, or modifying the gravitational wave from the impact of tides by two contributions. So one thing is this makes it a little more quadrupoly, so that adds a little more gravitational radiation. But the major effect is actually that as you go through different separations, you lose energy not only to the gravitational waves, but into the deformation of the star itself. So you're changing the energetics of the system based on the energy required to change the equilibrium state of the star, the mass distribution of the star that's deformed. So we characterize that by these lambda parameters that I was talking about earlier. They're related to the radius of the star. They are suppressed by the mass of the star. And this goes to the fifth power. So this really dominates what we learn. But there's also this Love number here, which is a correction factor, which comes from the fact that the radius only tells you about the outer layer of the star. And how easily the star deforms depends on how the matter is distributed within the star as well. So if it's sort of centrally condensed versus more uniform in density, that changes how it responds to a tidal field. That changes the impact that it'll have on the gravitational wave signal. So one thing to note is when we measure the impact of tides on a gravitational wave signal, we don't actually perturb isolated stars in any meaningful way to compute that characteristic response. So we use this lambda as a characteristic of isolated stars that is an effective descriptor of how matter changes the gravitational waveform. So there are basically models that we use to generate waveforms that only are only generated based on lambda 1 and lambda 2, but what goes into them can vary substantially, and they're consistent between these different models. So some of the models are what are these effective one-body semi-analytic models that talk about how, just like if you're doing a Newtonian orbit, you map the M1 and M2 to the total mass and a reduced mass. You can do an effective one body for the binary, a binary black hole or binary neutron star. So that gives you the green and yellow curves here. You can just do a perturbative estimate. That one kind of shoots up and diverges because it goes frequency goes to infinity. That's in the red there. You can take binary black holes and use a numerical relativity calibrated tidal correction. That's this blue guy. And you can use full GR and hydrodynamic simulations to get something that's challenging at low frequency, but more trustworthy probably through to the high frequencies up to the point where the stars collide. So what we see is that The binary black hole here is in white. All the tidal models kind of depart together from the binary neutron star. And then any general questions while I'm waiting, I guess? Do interpretive dance.
So before you're talking about how like binary neutron stars are good for explaining like that for process material like later in the universe, but not the earlier ones.
Yeah.
Can you just take some other explanation for that and just like add on top, or is it problematic to get to that pretty end?
Yeah, so it's so fortunately star formation was more active in the early universe. So the peak star formation was at redshift of 2 or so. So potentially you can add some process that tracks star formation more closely, and it will have fallen off enough by now that it doesn't mess up our local universe. So it turns out that if you, the alternative was to modify the delay time of the mergers. And it turns out you make them not have much of a delay time. So you're looking for some way of adding a contribution that tracks star formation, which can either be short delay time mergers or some other thing like exotic supernova of some kind. So there's these collapsar type models that that folks have also predicted, that Jenny Barnes and Dan Siegel and folks suggested as a way to, like, this isn't a new notice, like, so people have noticed before that there's more R process in the early universe than fits with the standard picture of mergers. The new thing that we're doing is trying to do that quantitatively so that we can actually infer the required properties of that additional process instead of just kind of hand waving something that might work. Yeah, that's kind of fun. That's one of the so one of the things I've been interested in lately is sort of, well, partly because, you know, we haven't had a new super loud neutron star merger. So what are the other things we're learning about nuclear astrophysics and the kinds of questions that community is interested in? And you know, the three questions I talked about are kind of some of the big questions of nuclear astrophysics as a whole, like what are the stellar processes that make black holes and neutron stars, like supernova. We're learning about those from the masses we see. What is the contribution to heavy element production? We're learning about those from the masses and the rates that we see. So even if we don't get anything loud enough to measure a direct tidal signature, we're still learning more about dense matter physics, especially as we get this population level picture of what gravitational wave sources look like.
So as you entertain this possibility that maybe something happened earlier to explain the tension with the R process, is there a way to sneak that into trying to explain the bump around 30 solar mass black hole? Or when it completely dissolves, it's completely disconnected?
I think they're disconnected because to get the matter to get flung out of a merger, you need at least one low mass component, and you probably need two relatively low mass components. So if you have something that's going to end up at 30 solar masses, that would be unless
I can flag out a supernova.
Yeah. So if there's some exotic supernova that likes to make 35 solar mass things and also flings out a bunch of matter, well, we could match up the rates and say if the rate we infer from the deficit is the same rate as we see in the excess. And if those would tell you, both would tell you like number of events per universe volume. And if they agree, then you could start thinking. But, you know, everything's got pretty big error bars for now, but eventually that would give you a potential tool to disfavor that kind of explanation too.
Any other questions for me?
Yeah.
Question for
Based on the
like chemical composition of like Earth and our solar system, can we like semi-confidently say that there was probably neutron stars involved in our abundance of elements? Or?
So, you can kind of answer that, like before we saw 1708-17, neutron star mergers were a serious contender. 1708-17 definitely added strong evidence that our process of via element production was actually happening in the afterglow. So if you see a kilonova, that is the like nuclear glow of radioactive decay of the neutron star matter down to heavy elements. That's what powers the kilonova. So all sort of kilonova observations suggest that process is happening, and at least one of them is pretty clearly from a neutron star merger. Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about next generation observatories. So that yellow curve there, that is an injected neutron star merger signal with next generation noise added to it and just plotted. So you don't need fancy statistics to find that thing. You could have a grad student just staring at the HT readout and say like, oh, we got another one. You actually have to be more worried about other mergers going off in the middle of that one and messing up your messing up your parameter estimates. But anyway, so I wanted to advertise that we have this potentially very sensitive instrument that we're trying to pitch now, potentially even being built in Canada. So some of the people involved in this project are at UBC, and there's been interest from some other Canadian folks, oh gosh, that I'm forgetting names of right now. But one of the cool things here is if you look at that plot, the lowest dotted line is roughly where our current sensitivity is. And there's three representative mergers that we've seen so far in total mass versus redshift. The blue line at the top of there is the desired horizon of the facility. So you would see more or less all the black holes that merge from the current generation of stars, plus anything that merges from the first population of stars, and potentially primordial black holes as well, before you would expect to see, or further than you would expect to see, any star-produced mergers. And we'd also see neutron star mergers as a function of time. So if you want to know how much they contribute to the R process, we would have a slice through the universe as a function of redshift about how many mergers are happening. So that would tell you much more directly how they're contributing to nucleosynthesis over time. So this would be pretty cool. We're doing site selection right now. Cal State Fullerton is one of the funded institutions trying to find a good place to locate this kind of thing. We're always trying to get bolstering of the science case. So if you have some idea of what you might be able to do with a gravitational wave source, that this kind of precision would make it possible to find, then you should join the Cosmic Explorer Consortium, which is basically a mailing list. There's no commitment, you'll just learn about white paper writing, and there's like a science call every month to learn about cool ideas. So I'll stop there, and thank you.
Thank you. So I guess we'll begin with asking if there are any questions from students for the speaker.
What's the sort of main difference with the instrument that you just showed? Yeah, is it like still an interferometer, sort of like LIGO?
It's big.
Big.
Yeah, there's a I'm not supposed to do it. So in the European proposal is the Einstein telescope, and it uses like a complicated series of nested interferometers, and it's underground and has like cryogenics and all sorts of cool stuff. Then there's the American version, which is like, let's do LIGO, but like 10 times as big. And since your H measurement is delta L over L, you make your L bigger, your delta L gets 10 times as bigger, roughly 10 times easier to measure with similar technology. So then you just need to find a big chunk of space to put it in, which North America actually has reasonably large amounts of land. So then you also have to make sure that wherever you build it, you have buy-in from the communities that historically have ownership or interest in that land. So that's what we're doing now.
Yeah, so related to that, you mentioned that site selection or site studies are already being carried out. So what's the funding
for
this experiment?
Yeah, so NSF has funded a number of institutions to do design-related work. You can look at the Cosmic Explorer website, and you can see where some of that work is being done. The site selection is Fullerton is one of the institutions that's active on that. So we're hiring a postdoc right now who will go around like making seismic measurements and finding good locations. And also working with communities that are based in any candidate location to see whether that's a good place where the instrument would be welcomed.
So I guess what I was asking was a dollar sign of this and then follow up question was the dollar sign of the experiment itself. Eventually.
Yeah, so it's a total $1 billion scale experiment.
And the funding secure so far is?
The millions? I don't know numbers offhand. You can look up the NSF awards for the institutions, but I'm sure we have a fancy story about this somewhere on someone university's press page, but I don't know the number offhand.
But is it correct that the funding, the future funding, is neither secure for ET nor for CE, right?
Yeah, ET has more of a commitment from potential host countries than Cosmic Explorer does. I should have studied up. I don't remember exactly where they are in their process either. So if you look at our timeline, Cosmic Explorer is about 5 years behind in terms of when construction would start. But you know, the ET doesn't have a final site selection either. The goal would be that, make sure I'm reading this, the goal would be that the site selection would take place around 2027. And that's sort of that's when actual like construction funding becomes possible or final design becomes needed. So
besides seismic noise and big open land, is there any other considerations take into account?
Well, a lot of it is, yeah, you need like stable power and, you know, infrastructure enough to build the thing, but not too much infrastructure so that's like human noise is noise for astronomical observations at this sensitivity. And then you don't want to be like accidentally trying to build on someone's sacred land and then running into that being something you didn't anticipate as a problem. So we're trying, as part of the surveying, is also meeting the people at different places and trying to check that that everyone would be happy to have a major project built in that particular location. So that's included in the site selection funding.
Any other questions in the room or on Zoom? No. Let's thank Jocelyn again.